Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me see what spring is like on Jupiter and Mars.
Hello and welcome to Season 2, Episode 17 of Space Talks, a half-hour science-based show with an interest in all things space. I'm Stephen Lowry, along with co-host Tim Woods, who's on Vancouver Island. And hello, Tim. Tell us about today's topic.
Well, Steve, if you keep up your reading about our universe long enough, you just can't avoid today's topic. We're going to talk about light, and we're going to talk about time and the unlikely relationship between the two. And while it's fascinating science, it's not as simple as turning on a flashlight or setting an alarm clock. But Steve, you've got an update.
Well, I do. This is with regard to the Canadian Space Agency's astronaut, Jeremy Hansen, who's scheduled to go on Artemis 2 to the moon. And Jeremy Hansen this week has been profiled on both CBC TV and CBC Radio. Kind of nice to know that even though his flight is probably a year away, that he's getting some airtime.
I actually wanted to mention about the Japanese program on the moon and also their program going to Mars. So they've been in the news quite a bit with their slim lunar lander, which, for lack of a better word, landed on its nose when it was landing on the side of the slope of a crater. And for a while there, it looked like all that hope and expectation for the rover and its two little sub-rovers was going to be all for naught. But somehow or other, it hung in there long enough for the solar panels to kick into gear when the moon's rotation was such that they got a bit of light on these solar panels that were nowhere near where they were supposed to be when the lander was upside down. And now it's fingers crossed that the minus 260 degree Celsius weather, the cold lunar night, to see whether or not that will just put this spacecraft out of business for good. But there's hope. Now, there was another one I was really excited about. It was a mission that Japan had all teed up to go in the spring of this year to Mars. It would have reached Mars later this year. However, they were going to be using a new, more powerful rocket to get to Mars. And I'm sad to report that it did not go well. And because of the orbiting patterns of Mars and the Earth, this postponement isn't for a few months. It's until 2026. So it gives you a little indication about how, best laid plans, something goes wrong, and wow, it's 2 years before you can try again. So that's it for the updates, and I think we're on to today's topic, and let's buckle up and ease into our look at light and its relationship to time. Step one is to reconsider the everyday language we use to describe light and how we see the world around us. Now, we're all familiar with a phrase associated with danger, and that's, of course, look out, which is actually a misnomer, which is easily understandable. This concept of you actively looking at something to see it with the sense that you're sending out some kind of energy beams from your eyes is called the emission theory of vision. And this misconception was actually championed by those ancient Greek philosophers like Plato, suggesting that our eyes are emitting some kind of a substance that interacts with external objects.
That's right, Tim. And as babies, our parents instructed us to look at objects. And I don't think it would be difficult to find adults who still think that we see things by having rays come out of our eyes to see an object. And of course, the opposite is true. When somebody says to a baby, "Oh, look at the pretty bouncing toy," what is actually meant is, "Turn your eyes to the toy so that light from it may enter your eyes, and then the retina will convert that light into electrical impulses and send them to your brain." And it's here that an amazing decoding process ensues. Now, we must remember that the brain is ensconced in a completely dark world bereft of light, sound, touch, pain, and smell, and yet it can interpret retinal electrical impulses, which are sent upside down, mind you, and then convert those images not only right side up, but with a field of depth. And watching young babies hone their mental skills of seeing objects and judging their distance is truly amazing.
Not only that, Steve, our brains are perceiving these objects in similar but not identical manners. Two people can be looking at the very same object and interpret it in somewhat different ways. For example, an item of clothing might appear as subtly different color shades. And if you've ever tried shopping for paint with your partner, you'll have entered into that dangerous zone of subjectivity.
So to be more objective rather than subjective, we humans must rely upon optical instruments for more consensus.
You know, and I don't think we're talking about merely putting on a pair of corrective glasses here to be. Rather, we're going to be talking about our old friend radiation, which is critical to understanding what we see. So, Steve, why don't you give us a brief review of the electromagnetic radiation spectrum and how it pertains to light?
Electromagnetic radiation is emitted energy of various wavelengths. And going from long to short wavelengths, we have invisible radio wave radiations, microwave radiations, infrared heat wave radiations, and then visible light wave radiations, which we see as red radiation, orange radiation, and so on to yellow, green, blue, and violet. None of these radiations are harmful at low levels, but the next batch can be. Wavelengths that are shorter than violet in color again become invisible to us. And these are ultraviolet wave radiation, X-ray wavelength radiation, and the worst of them all, gamma ray wave radiation.
Okay, so some of the shorter invisible wavelengths beyond the color violet aren't necessarily dangerous. I mean, it's okay to get sunlight consisting of ultraviolet rays, which our skin converts to vitamin D. But we all know from our youth that too much tanning will lead to sunburns, and decades later can, of course, be turn into cancer, skin cancer. So further, we know that diagnostic dental and body x-rays are also okay, but we have to be aware of and limit our annual dosages of these types of radiation. On the other hand, gamma ray wavelengths are just plain bad, and we try to avoid those at all costs. So let's recap. A little electromagnetic radiation is generally a good thing, but beware of getting too much. And interested listeners should prepare for an entire episode on cosmically occurring FRBs, or fast radio bursts, which are chock-a-block full of gamma rays.
Right you are, Tim. Light is the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum. And for now, let's just omit that word radiation out, as it tends to be, well, worrisome. Just as they no longer call diagnostic MRIs, which are magnetic resonating imaging, they don't call them NMRIs, where the N stands for nuclear. So if you're getting an MRI, you're actually getting a nuclear MRI. And people used to unnecessarily avoid getting such a procedure and receiving its spectacular diagnostic results for fear that they'd glow in the dark and, well, become the Hulk if agitated.
We don't want that. So here we are talking about light and how our understanding of light has changed. In other words, light's history. Steve, let's get into it. Give us a little history on our thinking about the nature of light.
Well, you know, Tim, it's kind of funny how in high school, history was my least favorite subject, but now it rather fascinates me because of its progression of thoughts, which lead to events. Now, for example, in the 17th and 18th centuries, there was debate over whether light consisted of particles or waves. Born in 1629, the brilliant Dutch mathematician and physicist Christian Huygens proposed the wave theory of light. Interestingly, though, the equally brilliant Isaac Newton, born later in 1642, supported the opposing theory, describing light as streams of particles.
So scientific thought just went around and around, and back in 1801, the genius of Thomas Young's famous double slit experiment came to the fore, and that showed that light exhibits interference patterns characteristic of wave behavior. And there have been numerous animations and videos that are still made and relevant. And you can find those on YouTube.
And so the revival of the wave theory of light was cemented by the gifted French physicist Augustin Jean Fresnel. Now, we pronounce that in here as Fresnel, but it's really Fresnel, whose remarkable research in optics led to the almost unanimous acceptance of the wave theory of light.
So for some reason, Steve, I think lighthouses were once equipped with Fresnel lenses, and I'm assuming that that has something to do with the same guy?
You're correct, Tim. Fresnel invented a lens which takes light from a bulb which spreads out in all directions and focuses it into a stronger parallel beam. Fresnel lenses used in lighthouses have been called, quote, the invention that saved the million ships. And indeed, the science historian Teresa H. Levitt remarked, quote, the moment a Fresnel lens appeared at a location was the moment that region became linked into the world economy.
Not know that. So, history and science intertwined. Now, let's talk about the dual nature of light with reference to it being a series of energy waves on the one hand and a series of particles, well, like mini snowballs at the same time. And you know, this reminds me of that old Sertz breath mint jingle. Mentioned how one item could be two things at the same time. I'm pretty sure there's lots of us out there who can remember this, Jim. Let's just, you know, have a listen to that one.
Sertz is a candy mint. Sertz is a breath mint.
Stop. You're both right. New Sertz is two mints in one. Stops bad breath in seconds. Tastiest mint of all. Yes, only new Sertz gives you two mints in one.
So apparently we're talking about light being a form of energy and yet a particle at the same time. It's a bit of a mystery.
If science only knew the definitive answer to that one, Tim. For over 100 years, the wave theory of light was held to be true until 1905, when our old friend Albert Einstein said, I don't think so, and proved the particle nature of light with his 1905 paper, which proposed a concept that light consists of tiny packets of energy known as light quanta or photons.
Aha! Here's our first mention of light being photons. Einstein did propose the dual nature of light, that is, being both a wave and a particle, but he wasn't able to prove it. And now, entering stage left, if you will, is that British quantum physicist Paul Dirac. And he was once described by writer Graham Farmelo in the 2009 biography as, quote, the strangest man, the hidden life of Paul Dirac.
You know, Tim, I've read that book, and trust me, it's a fascinating read. In 1927, Dirac published a mathematical theory of waves and particles. It was a theory of quantized fields, which weren't more accurately calculated until the 1940s by Richard Feynman, who was jointly awarded the Nobel Prize in 1965 for his work in quantum electrodynamics. Now, I've come across a lecture that he gave at the University of Auckland in which he talks at length about QED. And here's a small portion of him giving a brief history of this kind of radiation and QED. It's well worth the listen.
Another phenomenon that Newton had studied was light. But when Maxwell put together the laws of electricity and magnetism, he found out that the behavior that the equations he had produced expectation that would be behavior of waves that would propagate at a speed, which was figured out from electrical measurements. And so there was a new theory of light, which is that it was an electromagnetic wave. And Maxwell's great synthesis in 1873 was to connect electricity, magnetism, and light. Light is just one aspect of the electromagnetic wave, which can have different kinds of wavelengths from that point of view. And the spectrum we see with the eye is a very narrow range, and it's the entire spectrum. It's all put together with the one theory of electromagnetic waves. I'm going to talk about that part of it. I'm going to call it light instead of saying electromagnetic radiation. Light is what we see, is only one little part, but from the physicist's point of view, the accident that the human eye happens to be sensitive to waves from here to here is not essential. The phenomena are the same, you know, over the whole range, and I'm going to call them all light, but it could be radio waves or x-rays or what have you.
And in the interest of lifelong learning, listeners may be interested in the reading of Feynman's book entitled QED, The Strange Theory of Light and Matter, and that was published in 1985, which has more than a few interesting quotes, and there's a great one, here it comes. The price of gaining such an accurate theory has been the erosion of our common sense.
But before we get into its relationship with time, let's just delve a little deeper into its duality.
Sure. Well, as we all know, the primary source of light on Earth is our closest star, the Sun. And it produces photons through a process called radiation, recalling that a hydrogen atom consists of one proton and one electron. The Sun, of course, is so hot, it energizes the hydrogen to the extent that its electrons get separated from its protons, and in doing so, energy is lost from the nucleus. That energy is radiated as photons, which we see as sunlight.
And as we've heard, these photons are the basic units of electromagnetic radiation, which includes not only light, but radio waves, microwaves, X-rays, and gamma rays.
You know, what I find strange, Steve, is that photons have zero mass and therefore travel at the speed of light, and according to quantum mechanics, exhibits both wave-like and particle-like properties. Essentially, they are packets of electromagnetic energy.
And what I find amazing, Tim, is that although photons are produced throughout the sun has layers of a cloudy plasma material. And the liberated or freed, if you will, protons and electrons inside the sun interact with those newly produced photons. And that means a photon produced deep down inside the sun can only travel a few centimeters before it's reabsorbed.
And here's where we begin to mention light and time, Steve. This means that although a photon leaving the sun's surface and traveling at the speed of light reaches our planet in about 8 minutes and 20 seconds, a photon created at the sun's core can take an incredible 170,000 years to simply reach the surface because it undergoes a series of random walks through the dense solar plasma and constantly interacts with the stripped electrons and protons.
You know, Tim, when I learned of this photon diffusion time, I was utterly amazed, and I spent a lot of time imagining the life of a photon in the sun's core trying to make its way out. And it's utterly hard to believe that a photon, which can move at 300,000 kilometers per second, takes 170,000 years to get from the sun's core to its surface, when theoretically, it should only take 4 seconds. Talk about a traffic jam. Now, bearing in mind what happens to photons, within our well-formed middle-aged star, let's consider the first light created at the beginning of time when the universe formed. So tell us something about that, Tim.
You bet. Now, if you think about any depiction of the Big Bang, at least in some kind of an illustrated book, well, what you see is typically a brilliant flash of light, fireball, and voila, universe. Counterintuitively, though, the beginning of the universe was unimaginably hot, and the Big Bang was in fact a dark event. And that's what flows from this more accurate understanding of how light works.
Okay. So if this is the case, one analogy I can think of is, well, let's say a closet absolutely crammed to the gills with stuff. And if you open the door, all the contents spill out, but there's no flash of light.
Not bad. I think probably there are other analogies that get to the same end, but that's the drift. And one more thing, there wouldn't be any sound of an explosion as there's no medium for that sound wave to travel through.
Okay, so the Big Bang is a total misnomer. There'd be no flash of light, no noise. Oh, well, let's get back to light and how some kind of explanation as to why there wasn't any light at the beginning. You know, I'm rather confused with this notion because, well, I'm sure we're aware of Ray Bradbury's brilliant novel entitled Fahrenheit 451, so named because that's the temperature at which paper burns, and of course it produces light doing so. So if the universe was billions and trillions times hotter than 451, why wasn't there light?
First, let's go to the other end of the temperature scale, the cold side. And living in Canada, we know that it can be too cold to snow, which itself sounds like counterintuitive. Similarly, it can be too hot for light to travel, but don't take my word for it. Let's have a listen to Professor Brian Cox talk about the first light in the universe.
The universe expanded and cooled about 380,000 years after the Big Bang. The universe became cold enough for atoms to form. So before that, it was too hot for electrons to go into orbit around nuclei. So it was a plasma, essentially, and opaque to light. Light couldn't travel very far through it. But at that time, 380,000 years after the Big Bang, it became cold enough for atoms to form. Electrons went into orbit around nuclei, and the universe became transparent very quickly, actually. And so light could propagate through it. And so we can photograph that light, the most ancient light in the universe, and we have done with satellites like the Planck satellite, which is up in space now. So we have a whole sky photograph of that light, which is essentially a baby picture of the universe as it was 380,000 years after the Big Bang.
So there was no light for the first 380,000 years because the universe was so hot and dense that photons were constantly scattered and hindered. Now, when it's sufficiently cooled after 380,000 years, protons and electrons recombined to form atoms, and that allowed photons to travel freely. I think that's it.
That's right. And this first light is now known as the cosmic microwave background radiation, or typically CMB, and that was discovered in 1965. It's said to be the afterglow of the Big Bang, providing a snapshot of the universe as it was around 380,000 years after the universe began.
Okay, so let's cement this in place. The universe had a very hot, dense, and dark beginning. Some 380,000 years after that, it cooled enough for light to travel. And now, 13.8 billion years later, that first light, that cosmic microwave background radiation, is essentially everywhere in the universe. It permeates all of space and is observed coming from every direction in the sky. Wow, that's hard to understand.
Yes, but now time comes into the equation and things get even more confusing, at least to me anyway. Well, when we talked about that distance to the CMB, we often refer to the time it took for the light from the CMB to reach us. That light has been traveling for roughly 13.8 billion years, as you said, since the time of its emission. But it's essential to understand that this distance is not an actual distance as measured in kilometers, because space itself has been expanding since the Big Bang.
Okay, so it's not a measure of distance such as kilometers, but a measure of time. Okay. Now, speaking of time and distance, we're all familiar with the concept of driving a car to a destination. So let's say you want to travel 400 kilometers and average 50 kilometers per hour. Well, you'll get there in 8 hours. Go twice as fast, 100 kilometers per hour, and you'll get there in half the time, or 4 hours, and so on.
Right. So there's no problem there. The faster you go, the less time it takes you to reach your destination. Now let's extend that concept to speeding along not in a car at the snail pace of a measly 100 kilometers per hour, but at the speed of light, which is about 300,000 kilometers per second.
Okay, but before we do that, let's remember that no object with mass can travel at the speed of light, only fractions of that speed.
Right again. So let's hear renowned particle physicist Dr. Don Lincoln explain traveling along at fractions of the speed of light, and then the stunning summation of what travel at the speed of light would be like.
A super fast object will think it takes to get from Earth to the nearest star. The nearest star is about 4 light years away, so a person on Earth will say it takes 4 years to get there. How much time will a person traveling at 90% the speed of light take? Roughly 1 year and 9 months. How about at 99% the speed of light? A little over half a year. 99.9% the speed of light? About 2 months. We can continue this trend at the staggeringly fast speed of 99.9 more nines the speed of light. It will take a bit shy of 10 minutes. From this, we can conclude that in the limit of going at the speed of light, that a photon will experience zero time. So that's pretty wild. Taken to an extreme, this means that a photon can cross the entire universe in zero time. And it gets weirder. Not only does relativity predict that times will shrink, but it also predicts distances will too. A fast-moving object will shrink distances in the direction of motion, although not side to side. If we made a cylinder that stretched from here to the next star, we'd see it as 4 light years long, while the photon would see it as a circle with no thickness. Taken to the extreme, a photon views the distance traveled as it crosses the universe as having no thickness at all. In a sense, as far as the photon is concerned, it's everywhere along its path at once. So I think we can say that a photon experiences no time as it passes from place to place as it travels through the cosmos. Furthermore, it experiences all locations along its path at the same time. Photons are ageless.
Oh my goodness. Photons don't experience time. A photon can be anywhere at once along its path. Ugh, my mind is absolutely spinning.
That's for sure. You know, Steve, you can only laugh at this stuff. I mean, it made me think of that old TV show with Art Linkletter and his TV chats with little preschoolers. And he would sum it up by saying, kids say the darndest thing. Well, and scientists say the darndest things too.
You know, of all the concepts we've discussed in season one and two of Space Talks, this one of photons traveling along a path and being everywhere at the same time absolutely boggles my mind. You know, Tim, doing a little history again, the study of physics wasn't always called physics. It used to be called the study of natural philosophy. And keeping the word nature in mind, let's have a listen to Nobel laureate Richard Feynman describe nature.
Nature is strange as it can be in this sense, that the rules are so screwy, you can't believe them. Then there's a saying that you don't understand it, meaning, I don't believe it, it's too crazy, it's the kind of thing I'm not going to accept. So I'm going to ask you to try not to get turned off, and not to be afraid, relax, and enjoy it, realize that nobody understands it.
Well, there you have it, Tim. A Nobel laureate who specializes in QED saying that nature is so bizarre and counterintuitive that nobody really understands it. However, that being said, quantum electrodynamics provides a theoretical framework for understanding and engineering electronic appliances that involve the interaction of light and matter at the quantum level. Now, one might well ask, well, what are these strange esoteric devices which are based upon QED? Well, you may have heard of them since they are lasers, and QED explains the behavior of photons to produce coherent focused beams of light. Semiconductor devices, which are crucial for the operation of transistors and integrated circuits in our smartphones and computers. Optical fibers used in telecommunications and data transmission. Photovoltaic cells, which convert light energy into electricity, LEDs, which are used in everything from car headlights to Christmas lights, and Tim, the list goes on. Light is truly amazing.
Well, we've heard some crazy stuff today about how the universe worked, how it started, and this marriage between light and time. And it's not something that you're likely to, take with you without reading another book or watching another show, but it's a great insight and starting point to how this universe works and our evolving understanding of it. So that's all the time we have today on Space Talks. And until next time, this is Tim Woods.
And Stephen Lowry saying so long, and we'll see you next time on
Space Talks.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars, let me see what's